Our first matter is Salve Chipola versus Sean Flannery. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Chief Justice Ravner. Good morning, Associate Justices. This is Peter Kober, attorney for appellant Salve Chipola III.
Good morning, Your Honor. Christopher Ross of the Vigilante Law Firm, here on behalf of respondent Sean Flannery.
Morning, Chief Justice. CJ Griffin of Cashman, Stein, Walder, Hayden for Amicus Curiae, the New Jersey Center for Nonprofit Journalism, and the New Jersey Independent Local News Collective.
Good morning to all counsel. Mr. Kober, please proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice Ravner. I have come around to change my point of view on the issues presented by this appeal. I no longer believe that SWAN is unsound. I believe SWAN should be upheld. But I believe that SWAN should be limited to the facts of that case and the facts of similar cases. SWAN involved the use of the print media by the offending entity. In SWAN, the offending entity issued a press release. It disseminated a pass-along book. It posted on a bulletin board the certain offensive words. So in SWAN, the nature of the offensive words was clear and apparent. And in that, SWAN has much in common with all the media cases. The media cases involving print media, television, things posted electronically. In all those cases, the offensive words are clear, they're apparent. And in each one of those cases, a case of false light invasion of privacy would also qualify as a case of defamation. So those cases are the easy cases, but there is a different type of case. And this is the type of case that we are concerned with here. A case that does not involve any form of media, does not involve any print media, television, or posting anything electronically. These are cases that involve words that are communicated by other means. And often these kinds of cases arise in the employment context. Typically, an employee will be made aware of charges. The charges could be by a co-employee. The charges could be by a customer. The charges could be by someone at a work site to which the employee was assigned. But typically, what happens in these cases is that the employee is not aware, does not have access to the exact words used by the accuser. Typically, the employee has an idea of the gist of what the charges are about and when the alleged event that caused the charges to be occurred, but may not have the knowledge even of the identity of the informer or of the words used when the employee files suit. Those are the kinds of cases that we are concerned with here. Certain courts have recognized that there is indeed a class of cases that do qualify as false light invasion of privacy cases, but would not qualify as defamation cases. I will now give some examples of some courts which have realized that there is this distinction that exists. The first example I have is Covington versus the Houston Post. That case appears at 743 Southwest 2nd Reporters, 345. That is a Court of Appeals case in 1987. And in that case, the court said, the false light need not necessarily be a defamatory one, although it very often is, so that a defamation action will also lie. Citing Prosser on Torts, 5th edition, 1984, and that appears on page 347.
Mr. Kober, could you clarify for us what you're suggesting right now? You identified a category of cases like Swan, where presumably you're suggesting the one-year statute of limitations for a false light claim would be appropriate. Am I correct so far?
Yes. I agree entirely with the amicus brief that in those class of cases,
allow me to finish.
Is involved, the one-year statute of limitation would be appropriate. I've been persuaded.
At the same time, you're suggesting there may be some other false light claims where there should be a two-year statute of limitations?
Exactly. And I'm now going to get into the reasons for that contention of mine.
Don't you think that would be a bit confusing to have two different statutes of limitations for the same claim?
No. At the end of my presentation, what I was going to say is that what I am suggesting is there ought to be a dual approach here with the need for a threshold determination by the trial court as to whether or not the false light invasion of privacy claim also qualifies as a defamation case.
Are there, I understand you were going to give us examples of the different kinds of cases. Do those cases hold that false light has one of two different statutes of limitations?
No case holds.
So this would be a first.
If New Jersey were to be a first in the nation.
You know, I can think of certain reasons respectfully why no court has gone down this road. It would lead to a lack of clarity and arguably disparate treatment for the same tort. Can you address that?
Yes. The court in Rombauskas address the four different types of invasion of privacy claims. What I am suggesting is that false light invasion of privacy, if you actually examine it closely, it actually involves two types. So the false light invasion of privacy claim should properly be split into two different types, which should be handled differently, treated differently, and the threshold determination of which type it is should be made by the trial judge.
But by the time, counsel, that the trial judge makes that determination, the statute may have run on a plaintiff who has not properly anticipated this nuanced determination to be made by the trial court. Shouldn't we be focused on giving potential litigants and all parties as much clarity as possible as to what the limitations period is for a given claim?
Yes, we should be giving litigants as much clarity as possible by making it clear that when some kind of media is used, it's clear what the offensive communication was. Therefore,
when you say some kind of media, what are you referring to, particularly in 2024, where media encompasses a lot of different platforms?
All the kinds of platforms, every kind.
So posting something on social media, sending a text message that the plaintiff may later not have the exact words for, because you indicated that when media is involved, everyone has the exact words, which might not necessarily be the case. Posts on social media can be removed, can be not available by the time the rumor has already spread. So again, even that distinction that you're making between the use of media and the ability to always have the exact terminology, which I'm not sure that's necessarily the case, even that seems would lead to a significant amount of confusion with regard to exactly what category the false light claim falls into. Don't you think that would be the case?
No, it would not be confusion. It would result in the need for the trial court to consider each and every false light claim on a case-by-case basis, based on the circumstances there, as to whether or not that false light privacy claim would also be a case for defamation.
Or I understand you to be arguing that if it's a false light claim that could also constitute a defamation claim, then it would have a 1-year statute of limitation. Yes. And if the false light claim that would not constitute, could not be styled as a claim for defamation, then it should have a 2-year statute of limitations. Even if we accepted your argument, I'm not sure what that has to do with publication, as you're saying, or why you think your case would fall on the non-defamation side. Defamation, as far as I understand, can be either verbal or written. Slander is specifically spoken, whereas libel is specifically written, and defamation can be spoken just as easily as it can be written. And both amici and defendant here were arguing that this would be, that your claim, even though styled as false light with the false light label on it, would actually constitute not only a claim of defamation, but a claim of per se defamation, because the allegation is that the statement was that defendant had been engaged in some sort of criminal offense, which is defamation per se. So can you speak to where are you coming up with this distinction that defamation can never be spoken? And even if that it were the case, how do you respond to the allegations from amici and defendant that your claim is a claim of defamation, even though it's not labeled as such, because it focuses on the reputational harm to your client and indeed focuses on an allegation that a criminal offense was imputed to your client, which would constitute defamation per se?
Yes. Certainly, a defamation claim can be slander. That is included in the umbrella of defamation claims. And in the type that I'm talking about, the type that typically comes about in the employment context, where charges are made against an employee, typically the offensive words were spoken words, slander. That's typically what happens. And typically what happens is that the charged employee is bewildered at the time 1 year comes around because she doesn't know what the words spoken were. She often can't identify the informant. And although she knows the date where the offending occurrence occurred, she doesn't know enough about this to make a claim of defamation on the 1 year anniversary of her claim. So that is typically what happens. So let me go on, because I think to answer all the justice's questions, I have to expand more where I'm coming from. And after the citations of cases which distinguish between the two, which hold that there can be false light invasion of privacy cases which are not defamation cases. And I have several of those besides Covington. I have McGinnis versus Fisher Broadcasting Incorporated, 798 Pacific Second Reporter 1106. That's an Oregon Court of Appeals case, 1990. Which involved a television broadcast. And it says a person need not be defamed to bring a false light claim. And that appears on page 1108. Also,
Mr. Kober,
yeah.
Are any of these in your written submissions to the court so far?
They're not.
This is a new argument that you're presenting for
this
the first time now.
It
so
is.
Given that you reserved 15 minutes for your presentation, which we've already used, I'm going to suggest you do your best to try to wrap up this new argument and then move to the argument that you had advanced up until now as to why this should be a 2-year as opposed to a 1-year statute of limitations, setting aside the hybrid scheme that you're mentioning. So please finish up this, if you could, succinctly, and then follow up with the original argument.
Yes, I'll move on. So in the case where the claimant is not aware of the words used, perhaps not aware of the informant, there are ways in which such a case could be a false light invasion of privacy case, but not qualify as a defamation case. And that can happen in at least two ways, which I'm not limiting myself to. But the first way is in Boyd versus Wakefern Food Corporation. Nope, that's not it, wrong case. The first way is in Strollo versus Jersey Central Power and Light Company. That a case appears at 20 New Jersey Miscellaneous Reports, 217, 26 Atlantic Second Reports, 559. And the court there held that the allegations in that case did not sound in defamation, so they weren't defamation. But more importantly, the biggest hurdle that defamation plaintiffs have to overcome is the hurdle presented by Zonrich versus Overlook Hospital, which is 212 New Jersey Super 83, 514 Atlantic Second Reports 53. That's an appellate division case where certification was denied by the Supreme Court, 107 NJ 32, and that's from 1986. In that case, a physician alleged defamation and slander against a hospital, its board of trustees, and co-employees for charges made against her challenging her competency. It was held that a defamation complaint must plead facts sufficient to identify the defamatory words, their utterer, and the fact of their publication. A vague conclusory allegation is not enough. Rather, the complaint must identify when, where, by which defendants, and by what words, written or oral, plaintiff was defamed. So the burden of overcoming Zonrich is very real on defamation plaintiffs. So in the examples that I've been presenting, very often, because a plaintiff can't overcome Zonrich, a potential defamation plaintiff will not qualify as a defamation plaintiff, but that plaintiff could qualify as a false light invasion of privacy plaintiff. And I'm suggesting that that type of plaintiff should be subject to the 2-year statute of limitations. One quick—
Sorry, order. Can you clarify? Do you have any case explaining that a plaintiff can sue for false light if they don't allege that any particular words but were uttered by any particular person? You're saying that if you don't know who said the defamatory statement or what was said, you can't sue for defamation. But what court says that if you don't know who said what, you can still sue for false light?
The cases defining the elements of false light do not say, what they do not say is what's important here. They do not say that the words have to be identified.
I'm not sure where you're getting that from. I'm looking in Romaine versus Callinger, which says that to prove false light, a plaintiff must show that the defendant had knowledge of or acted in reckless disregard as to the falsity of the publicized matter and the false light in which the plaintiff would be placed, which seems, and that's a New Jersey case, and that seems to indicate both you need to have knowledge of the defendant who publicized the matter, and the defendant had to act in reckless disregard as to the falsity of the publicized matter, which seems to mean you have to have some sort of false publicized matter.
Yes, but you don't have to have the words. You can have some idea of the gist of the falsely publicized matter without knowing the words that were used.
So which case says that? That you don't need words, you can just have the gist that something false may have been stated?
No case addresses that, but the cases are uniform in telling us what is not required. When they list the elements, knowing what the words were is not required in a false light invasion of privacy claim.
Mr. Cooper, if I understand correctly, you're still on the argument, the novel new argument, that certain false light claims would have a 1-year and certain would have a 2-year statute of limitations. This is, as I'm sure you can understand, this is not how oral arguments typically proceed, where the court and opposing counsel are hearing new arguments for the very first time, and we've spent now a good deal of time on this. So I'm going to ask you to move to the argument that you had presented to the court in the cert petition and in the briefing in this case, and succinctly give it to us in the next few minutes, please.
The argument there is one that I've been persuaded was wrong based on the amicus brief. I think that Swan was decided in the way it was because it false light invasion of privacy presents a special type of claim. There's a danger that a false light invasion of privacy claim will be used to circumvent the 1-year statute of limitation, and that can't be allowed by the courts, quite frankly. That's intolerable.
I mean this in not in an argumentative way. Is there a reason you didn't present in advance of oral argument the new theory that you are advancing today as your argument?
I understand the court's concern here, but yeah, time constraints were the only reason.
Please do your best to bring your argument to a conclusion. I understand you're no longer advancing the original position.
All right. Okay. So to bring my argument to a conclusion, I now advocate a standard that actually has been adopted by a number of courts. So I turn the court's attention to Magennis versus Fisher Broadcasting Incorporated, 798 Pacific Reporter 2nd, 1106. That's an Oregon Court of Appeals case, 1990, which involved a television broadcast. And in that case, the conclusion of the court was, when a claim characterized as false light alleges facts that also constitute a claim for defamation, the claim must be filed within the period for bringing a defamation claim. So there, Magennis recognized the qualifier that the claim characterized as false light must also allege facts that could also constitute a claim for defamation. Another case is Jensen versus Sawyers, 130 Pacific 3rd Reporter 325, Utah 2005, involving a television broadcast. That case, the statute of limitations for defamation governs claims based on the same operative facts that would support a defamation action. In recognition of the possibility that a false light invasion of privacy claim may turn on operative facts that do not include defamation, we further limit our holding to the facts present here, and we extend the 1-year limit to false light invasion claims that flow from the facts here, which were media statements. Swan itself kind of got to this same conclusion. In Swan, it says that we hold that we predict the Supreme Court would conclude that the 1-year statute of limitation governing defamation actions would be applied in a false light action that was clearly grounded in allegations which were defamatory. That's in Swan itself. And this conclusion is also consistent with the restatement second of torts itself, which says when the false publicity is also defamatory, so that either action can be maintained by the plaintiff, It is arguable that limitations of longstanding that have been found desirable for the action for defamation should not be successfully evaded by proceeding upon a different theory of later origin, in the development of which the attention of the courts has not been directed to the limitations. And that appears in Restatement Second of Torts, Section 652E, 1977, Comment E. So to summarize my position that I advocate for the resolution of this case is a remand to the trial court for determination as to whether this case on its facts qualifies also as a defamation case.
Just to be clear, if it does qualify as a defamation case, it's outside of the 1-year statute of limitations.
If the case does qualify as a defamation case, it's subject to the 1-year statute of limitations. If the case would not qualify as a defamation case for the reasons we've discussed here in this argument or any other reason, then it ought to be subject to the 2-year statute of limitations for personal injury actions. Because the reason for having a 1-year statute of limitations because of false light invasion of privacy claim could also be a defamation claim. The reason no longer exists if the false light invasion of privacy claim would not qualify as a defamation claim. So it should be subject to the 2-year statute of limitations under those circumstances for personal injury actions.
If I just have one follow-up, that's okay. Counselor, I assume then that analysis of whether they're co-sanguineous or not would be conducted pursuant to an analysis of the conduct at issue pursuant to McGrogan, and not an analysis of the claim or the injury, but of the conduct, right?
I'm sorry, Justice Hoffman, I'm having trouble hearing you.
I'm assuming that the analysis that you are talking about would be conducted pursuant to conduct, would be the analysis of the conduct, not of the claim, not of the injury, but as McGrogan says, conduct is what's critical in determining whether they're similar or the claims are similar or distinct. Are you agreeing with me that that analysis would be one of conduct?
The trial judge's analysis would be one of conduct. How the offensive communication was communicated. That would be the nature of the conduct. That would be the nature of the analysis too. Was the aggrieved person in a position to have enough knowledge of what was communicated to also have been qualified to file a defamation claim?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Your Honor, I would like to use my opening statement just to reorient the court. The issue before this court is, does a claim alleging false light invasion of privacy have a 1-year statute of limitations? It is my position that it does have a statute, 1-year statute of limitations. In Swan, that's been examined by this court, the appellate division, relying on this court's guidance in Rumbaskis, held that not only is a false light invasion of privacy subject to a 1-year statute of limitations akin to defamation, but a litigant can also not simply repackage their defamation claim into a false light claim to evade the statute. Swan is on point in this matter, both factually and legally. It's so on point that my opposing counsel at my motion to dismiss had actually conceded that Swan required the dismissal of his case. However, we found ourselves on appeal. Ironically, Swan had warned us of the conduct of repackaging that claim, which is, in my opinion, on full display in this case. The court had warned that to allow someone to take a defamation claim and label it a false light claim would condone a transparent evasion of the 1-year statute of limitations in New Jersey. There's a clear transparent evasion in this case. In both plaintiffs in Swan and the plaintiff in this case had used similar language to describe their claims. Both alleged that the defendant knew the statements were false or acted in reckless disregard of their falsity, and that the statements would be highly offensive to a reasonable person. Most importantly, only reputational harm was alleged by the plaintiff in Swan, and only reputational harm has been alleged by the plaintiff in this case. Swan was also correct legally. They did not pull their legal reasoning out of thin air. They relied on this court's guidance in 1994 in Rumbaskis. In that case, this court had undertaken an analysis of invasion of privacy as a whole. In that case, it was based on intrusion into seclusion. However, they did examine false light and how it's treated in other states. And there is language in that case that suggests that it would be treated akin to defamation in this in our state as subject to the one-year statute of limitations that defamation is subject to. The court in Rumbaskis clearly recognized the inherent differences in a false light claim and an intrusion into seclusion claim. And in recognizing those differences, they held that an intrusion claim is subject to a two-year statute of limitations akin to an injury to the person. However, they did not ultimately have to make a finding on the false light claim. And you have to forgive me, Chief Justice. I had understood my adversary's argument prior to today to mean that Swan was incorrectly decided because it failed to consider McGrogan and Montells. My position is that if we examine it through the Montells and McGrogan framework, the result would be the same. It would require the dismissal of the plaintiff's claim because we would look to the injury. And looking to the injury, the only injury alleged is a reputational damage to the reputation or reputational harm. That is akin to what the injury is suffered from a defamation plaintiff. We look to reputational harm. And finally, just from a public policy and common sense standpoint, if you can simply repackage your claim to avail yourself of a longer statute of limitations, what's to stop every litigant from doing the same? The appellate court has been consistent in holding that you cannot simply repackage your claim. And they've held that prior to Swan, they held it in Swan, and they've continued to hold that after Swan. Statute of limitations are supposed to provide efficiency and penalize delay. The repackaging that's been done in this case really flies in the face of the general principles of statute of limitations. It is undisputed that the plaintiff here had filed his claim approximately almost 2 years after the alleged publication, which would be a violation of the one-year statute of limitations for defamation. So we are respectfully requesting that this court affirm the appellate division, foreclose on the strategy of simply repackaging for future litigants, and rule that a one-year statute of limitation applies to a false light invasion of privacy claim. And that would conclude my opening statement.
Questions, anyone? Mr. Ross, is there anything you'd like to expound upon?
Judge, I can, Your Honor, attempt to address Mr. Kober's argument. The only comment I would have to his new position is that the standard he's advocating for seems entirely unwieldy. And I believe, Your Honor, the Chief Justice had commented on that. It would lead to confusion. From my position, Your Honor, I don't see how it could be a workable standard. If the threshold determination is made by the trial court, how would a litigant such as an attorney in my position or my client know really what we're defending against until that threshold determination is made? And what I mean by that is if a plaintiff files a complaint, do I then have to file a motion to have this determination made? Is it made sua sponte by the court? Now I'm expending resources to try and address this threshold concern. And I don't think there's going to be any real concrete information a litigant's going to have until after that's made, which could change trial strategy, could change settlement negotiations. It could change a number of things that I just don't believe really comports with the general principles of the practice of law in this state. Justice Wehner after had raised a good point regarding slander and libel. It sounds to me as if Mr. Kober's advocating that we would now create either a fifth invasion of privacy claim, or we would bifurcate false light into two baskets. However, slander and libel, is my understanding, they're subject to the same statute of limitations in this state. And I believe this court, if it were to entertain Mr. Kober's argument, should remain consistent and hold that even if we were to bifurcate that, it should be held to the same statute of limitations. To do otherwise would lead to inefficiency and confusion.
Counsel, I want to follow up a little bit on a question that I struggled with as I read through some of the cases. Maybe you can help me. It feels like Swan talks about the notion that the statute of limitations should be analyzed by the nature of the claim. It feels like Montel's talks about the notion that the statute of limitations should be analyzed by the nature of the injury. And then it feels like McGrogan talks about the fact that the statute of limitations should be analyzed by the nature of the conduct. Maybe you can help me understand how it is that you synchronize those three holdings, which seem to talk about a different perspective in analyzing what statute is appropriate.
Sure, Justice Hoffman. And I had kind of tried to figure that out myself. And my answer would be two parts. I think my general answer would be that Swan was really following the lead of Rimbauskas, and this court had provided guidance. So I don't think, in my opinion, the Swan court wouldn't necessarily have to go through the entire framework because this court had already provided its guidance that these would be treated generally akin to defamation. However, the way I understand it, Your Honor, is that Montel's would tell us to look at the nature of the injury, and that would be the threshold. That would be the starting point of that analysis. So we would look at the nature of the injury, and applying that to our case, the nature of the injury is simply reputational harm. And then McGrogan says after, my understanding is McGrogan says after we look at the nature of the injury, we then look to the conduct, because we have to look at the conduct on a case-by-case basis. So I believe, Justice Hoffman, applying that framework would be Montel says, look at the nature of our injury. We get to the general characterization of what type of injury does that plaintiff suffer. And in Montel's, the court looked at New Jersey law against discrimination claims and ultimately held that regardless of the claim that's brought forth under New Jersey law against discrimination, subject to a 2-year statute of limitations for an injury to the person. So after we look at what the general characterization is of that injury, I think then we go into what conduct has been alleged. If that makes sense to Your Honor.
It does make sense. And I think it's a laudable effort to try and synchronize those three. I'm not positive, and you may or may not have a reaction to this. I'm not positive that McGrogan says it's a 2-step process, go to injury and then go to conduct. I think McGrogan might say is that the injury helps inform conduct, but conduct is the analysis that is most relevant. But I will admit, I think both of us probably in trying to synchronize those cases have struggled with how to read them together.
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with Your Honor. I think in my mind, trying to apply that to this case, I looked at it as a 2-step process just by some of the language McGrogan had used. But I don't think it's a formal, you know, step one and then we go to step two. I don't think that's if that's how it seems I'm advocating that case, I don't mean to. That's just kind of how I've developed the rationale of how to comport those cases together.
And what I think you're saying is claim, injury, conduct, for purposes of this case, it's all the same because that analysis would yield the same result.
I think so, Judge. I think if you look at the general characterization of an injury in this case is clearly reputation. And then I think to take it a step further, if you look at the actual conduct alleged in this case, it's also conduct affecting the reputation. So I think both pieces of the puzzle, so to speak, come together in this case when we apply Montel's and McGrogan, because we have the general injury suffered by a plaintiff what I would argue is a defamation case, as is here, is reputational harm. And that's been held and that's been noted in our case law. And in this case specifically, the only thing really alleged is reputational harm. And there is some language in the complaint. I believe there's one mention in paragraph 47 that the plaintiff had suffered emotional distress. But that emotional distress in and of itself finds its genesis in the defamation. And you don't get to that emotional distress without zooming back and saying, okay, well, here, we start with the reputational harm.
So Mr. Ross, both just now and in your briefing, I thought I heard an argument that where a false light claim is simply, you know, slapping a false light label on allegations that are clearly grounded in defamation because they are alleging injury to reputation, then the statute of limitations should be 1 year because that's the statute of limitations for defamation. And we don't want to encourage people to, you know, mislabel their claims in order to avoid the 1-year statute of limitations. But I hadn't understood you to be making a broader argument of there can never possibly be any false light claim that does not sound in reputational harm or does not sound in defamation and therefore should have a longer statute of limitations. And we wouldn't even have to reach that in this case because, as you pointed out, the complaint here does repeatedly allege reputational harm, which is really the crux of defamation and really also alleges defamation per se, in that the allegation is that the plaintiff was engaged in criminal activity. So in theory, we, for purposes of your argument, I had not understood you to be making a broader argument that we would have to say there can never be a case that does not sound in defamation under false light. Instead, for purposes of a case like this that does sound in defamation, the statute of limitations should be 1 year.
And I apologize, Justice Wainwright-Raptor, I might be confusing myself. My argument is in this case that this is simply a defamation claim that's been given a new label to try and subvert the statute of limitations, which was explicitly warned against in Swan. I guess in a broad sense, Justice, I may be arguing that there may never be that situation, but I'm specifically trying to limit my argument, and I apologize, Justice, to this case. This is simply, you know, we have claim A, we slapped label B on it, and now we're trying to move forward with it.
Can you think of an example where a false light claim would be independent of the elements of defamation? Understanding that's not this case.
Yes, Justice. My understanding is it's a little quirky, is because not all false light claims can be defamation claims, but all defamation claims can sort of become a false light claim because they both they both require falsity. So I'm not sure, Justice Patterson, off the top of my head, if I can really come up with an example, because they are so intertwined. And I know Amicus in this case has actually advocated to eliminate the false light claim. And Prosser had, and I'm not going to advance Amicus's point. I'm sure CJ will do a good job of that. But the point is, you know, they're both so inextricably tied together because we require that falsity element. And Prosser had actually warned about that in his Law Review article. In his conclusions, he says there's questions that still remain. Would false light eventually rise up and swallow up defamation as a whole? And I think that is a genuine concern to have. And that article, I believe, was published in 1960. We're in 2025, and we're still sort of dealing with that concern. And I had briefed the issue in my response to the Amicus brief. I think there is a genuine concern that by allowing someone to simply repackage, why wouldn't all litigants simply change the language of their defamation claim, bring the false light claim, and now we're sort of dealing with the fact that defamation may become archaic.
But if the statute of limitations on the two is the same, then cases can continue to be decided and explore the nuances of those distinctions with really nobody being prejudiced. Am I correct?
I believe you're absolutely correct, Justice Patterson. I believe if the statute of limitations is the same for both claims, there's really no prejudice to a litigant. And in fact, a litigant could still then bring both claims, as oftentimes litigants will bring a multitude of claims that may be intertwined or interrelated. However, it becomes, I think, a more uniform standard or a more uniform statute of limitations. It provides more clarity to a litigant, and it forecloses, by holding the same statute of limitations, forecloses on this fear that you're simply going to repackage your claim.
And just to clarify, the only reason we're talking about all of this at all is false light is a common law claim. If the legislature wanted to codify some sort of cause of action for false light and create any statute of limitations that it wanted to, it of course could do so. It just hasn't. And that's why we're trying to figure out what the best statute of limitations is to apply where it's a common law claim, where the legislature has not spoken about either the claim or the timeframe in which it wants it to be brought, correct?
That's my understanding, Justice Wainwright-Raptor. And I believe going further off your point, I think part of the confusion comes because invasion of privacy is almost an umbrella term with four distinct claims that fall underneath that umbrella. And maybe they're part of the same category, but they're really, I believe, unrelated claims. Because if you look at the proofs that need to be advanced for each different claim, I think the general theme is that we would like people to be left alone and be private. But the four claims that fall under that umbrella really are so unrelated, it's, I think it's a struggle to really figure out where they fit in terms of at least statute of limitations.
Other questions, anyone? Mr. Ross, is there anything you'd like to add to your argument?
No, Your Honor. I would just like to thank the court for its time.
Thank you. We'll hear next from C.J. Griffin.
May it please the court. As you can imagine, my argument feels a little differently now than it did this morning, given Mr. Kober's change in position. And I suppose it's always nice to hear that your amicus brief was persuasive even to an adverse party. I'm frankly kind of not sure why we're here anymore, because the certified question is about whether it cites Swan and is about whether Swan applies. And Mr. Kober's conceded that it does apply where the claim is also defamation. And there's no need for a remand in this case because what he has pleaded is defamation per se, falsely accusing someone of a crime. That's slander per se. And so there's no need for a remand. That would be just additional procedures that the poor defendant in this case would have to pay to defend against. And so I'm not quite sure why we're here. What Mr. Kober seems to be advocating for is something completely outside the facts of this case, which would be an advisory opinion about in other contexts where it's an employment case and you don't know exactly what was said, can you bring a false light claim? And in that regard, essentially what he's asking is the court to say, well, okay, you can evade the rules for defamation about pleading specificity and the discovery rule, and you can have an extra year to be able to bring it as a false light claim instead. And that can't be the rule. The reason why those rigid rules are in place for defamation is because this involves speech. We have a right to free speech. And so the ability to punish speech, whether civilly or criminally, is very narrow. And so exactly what he's asking for in this case is the ability to evade all those defamation protections via another cause of action, false light. I think Mr. Ross did a very good job responding to Mr. Kober's argument and explaining why he should prevail in this case, so I won't expand upon that. I will say, Justice Patterson, in terms of your question about examples, it is very difficult to think of an example that would be false light that wouldn't also be defamation. And courts have also struggled with this too, which is why Florida and Texas and Colorado and about a dozen states have decided that they are going to reject the tort of false light altogether, because they've held that they can't really, that they've looked at all the case law in their jurisdictions and they can't find a case where it was false light but not defamation. And so it wasn't worth keeping this tort that ends up resulting in additional defense work for the defendant in those cases. It confuses courts and is really abused by plaintiffs to try to evade defamation protections. So they have rejected this tort altogether. And of course, we asked the court to do so in our amicus brief as well. I did do a lot of work on my amicus brief to try to be helpful to the court. And so, of course, it would be a bummer if the court improvidently dismissed this case, although it'd probably be a good outcome for the defendant because this is a very frivolous action. And so I know frivolous litigation letters were served, and the court taking this matter as cert might make it difficult to obtain sanctions. Thankfully, we now have an anti-SLAPP statute that's in place that doesn't apply to this case, but would protect future such actions. But I do think that, it would be appropriate for the court to take a look at this case. And it's happened so many times. We didn't cite the unpublished opinions in our case, but there are numerous unpublished appellate division decisions where courts have rejected these additional claims when they're tacked onto a defamation claim. And what plaintiffs are doing now is exactly what happened in this case. They've said, well, all these cases have disposed of the defamation cases claim, and then additionally said, well, because the defamation claim fails, so do all these other claims. And this court has done that in Decker and GD. The appellate division has done it in many other unpublished cases. And so now plaintiffs have wised up and said, hey, let's just not plead the defamation claim and only plead the tort to try to avoid those rules. And so if this court were to do away with this tort, as many other states have done, it would at least take care of that abuse. In terms of prejudice, it It's, you're correct that it's not a significant prejudice, but it does require additional defense work when this claim is brought as a way to evade the defamation protections. You have to brief it. You have to explain the law to the trial court. It raises some confusion and that sort of thing. And if the court were to reject the common law, the legislature, if it disagrees, of course, could reinstate it via a statute and also set forth the appropriate statute limitations. As Mr. Ross alluded to, Prosser himself questioned this tort. His scholarship went on to be the restatement, but he questioned whether exactly what has happened in this case would happen. And so I sort of will leave my argument there. I'm happy to answer any questions, but we would just ask the court to reconsider this in general if the court does issue an opinion in this case.
One question, counsel. You've raised some very thoughtful arguments in a fine brief, but the way in which this case has proceeded, the argument was first raised by one amicus, wasn't litigated before this point, and other amici didn't have the opportunity to weigh in on the argument because it didn't get brought out at the outset. Wouldn't it make more sense to wait for a litigated case where the issue is front and center for all to have the opportunity to weigh in before doing away with false light?
I can certainly see that being a sensible approach. I think a sensible approach in light of the significant change here might be the court not issuing an opinion at all and leaving Swan in place because it has worked for 15 years. Trial courts have been able to apply it. And if at some point we get here again, then that could be an avenue. But of course, it's very rare. It's very unlikely that a case gets here anytime soon. And so as amicus, we took the opportunity to explain to the court why other jurisdictions have rejected this tort altogether and encourage the court to do so.
Understood. Any questions, anyone? Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.